Believe me, I showed him. Dana shook her head and chuckled. She watched the health worker. She was a woman in her early 20s. She was a northerner, a volunteer with the One Country Coalition, doing her year of service.
You remember when they gave us that stuff?
Dana asked. Surratt nodded. Told him we were too old for it. Probably didn't do anything.
Maybe it did. Maybe we'd be dead if we didn't take it.
Marcus's dad says anyone who stays in the camp too long is going to die here, Surratt said.
You think we're going to die here?
Dana thought for a while. Across the road, the health worker was shooing away a gaggle of children she knew as repeat customers, trying to get their hands on the caramel candies she handed out after every vaccination.
No,
Dana said.
Well, maybe 100 years from now, but not like tomorrow.
All right,
Surratt said.
100 years is all right.
In the face of the children's pleading, the health worker relented and gave all the candies away. Soon the children began to dissipate, their small jaws mining hard for sugar. Dana leaned close to her sister, resting her head on Surratt's arm.
I'm sorry for saying you should grow up,
she said.
Don't ever grow up. Don't ever change, beautiful girl.
The health worker passed from tent to tent. She asked the children their ages. Some knew and others didn't. Those who didn't, she asked to raise their right arms over their heads, such that the crease of the elbow rested somewhere near the top of the head, and the fingers dangled around the left ear. The children whose fingers touched their ears, she estimated to be older than 5 years of age, and for them the vaccine would do no good. On this basis, the vaccines were administered. A few drops of clear liquid to ward off the viral paralytic that had long ago been defeated, but now, riding the saddle of war, returned. Late at night, when the weather cooled and the camp's ragged bustle gave way to the hard, graceless sleep of the dispossessed, Martina visited her friend Erica Yarber's tent for a game of cards. For the better part of 5 years, this had been a ritual, practiced 3 or 4 times a week by Martina, Erica, their friend Lara, and whichever women from the neighboring tents decided to join them on any given night. It was a large tent, near the border between Alabama and South Carolina, once occupied by Erica, her husband, and her teenage son. But the son had moved west to join the fighting, and the husband's heart gave out one morning, and now she lived alone. Martina arrived with a jar of pickles, red in their Kool-Aid brine. Their taste repulsed Martina, conjuring cherries marinated in sweat, but the other women enjoyed them. The women almost always brought with them something to eat or drink, boiled in dry peanuts, day-old cafeteria bread massaged with oil or bacon grease, sweet ears, kettle chips, a mason jar of corrosive, tent-made joyful, in addition to whatever else the women managed to acquire that day through serendipity or altruism. The game was fight the landlord, $10 a point, first to 100. They used 3 decks, and in this way the game moved more quickly and opportunities for bombs and rockets were increased. They played by the light of rainbow candles made from melted crayons and shoelace wicks. On a nearby tablet, a Dixie radio broadcast trickled from the speakers. It was a big-lunged, brass-backed man singing, "Young love has made me old, tired, restless, and blue."
"Mag on mag, nines on eights,"
Martina said, laying 6 cards on the shaky plywood table.
"Nope,"
Lara said.
"Nothing,"
Erica followed. Martina swept the hand and set it face down in a neat pile in front of her. Lara's joyful was starting to do its work. It had become, over the years, the South's wartime drink. Joyful, a Frankenstein hooch made from whatever was on hand, no 2 jugs ever the same. Martina took another swig. She tasted the ingredients of this particular batch, a festering, months-old orange juice, and beneath that an aftertaste of corn and mouthwash. She felt the onset of drunkenness. Every once in a while, the candle flames stood still, and it was the room that flickered. Soon the game was called, and Martina collected her winnings, and the ladies retreated to Erica's small, makeshift living room. Here there were arranged a set of cushions made of stitched charity blankets and foam. With no couch to use as a base, the cushions were arranged flat on the ground in the style of a Bouazizi majlis. The arrangement was sectioned with low tables made of the discarded cardboard boxes in which the camp's water bottles came. The women sat on the cushions and left the door of the tent ajar to let in a little breeze. Soon Erica was fast asleep where she sat. It was quiet, Erica's snoring their only accompaniment. Between the joyful and the good tobacco, a warming balm washed over Martina's body, and the pains of the day began to recede.
"You know, I had a sister once," she said.
"You never told me that before,"
Laura replied.
"Never told no one. Never told my husband, even. She died when I was 5. I don't remember nothing about her anymore, except she had thumbs that could bend both ways. She used to show that off all the time, soon as she figured out nobody else could do it."
Laura sat upright against the cushions. She blinked a few times to shake off the weight that had been building on her eyelids.
"How'd she die?"
she asked.
"Got a cold one day playing in a creek that ran by our house. By nighttime she was shaking and coughing up blood. She was dead by morning. Didn't even take a whole day. I remember my parents wouldn't let me in the bedroom, didn't want me seeing her the way she was. But I was out in the hallway and I could hear it, the sound she made when she was fighting so hard to breathe. I wish they would have let me see her. I think just the sound of it alone is worse than if they'd let me see her."
"I'm sorry," Laura said.
"That must have been hard."
"Ah, it's all long gone now. Time buries time, my mother used to say.
It broke my father, though. For months afterward, he just went round talking about how there used to be drugs that could have fixed her right up, but everybody used them too much, and they didn't work anymore. And what did work, we couldn't afford. He kept saying it over and over, like saying it would change things."
Martina stamped out her cigarette butt in her empty measuring cup.
"I remember the day we buried her. We brought this preacher out to the farm to say a few words. Man must have been 100 years old, half blind, and pretty well senile. He walks up to the grave. My parents dug a plot for it right there on the farm, made a cross out of fence posts. He walks up to the grave, and we stand behind him, all dressed up in the finest clothes we own. And we think he's just going to read a passage or just say a couple nice things about heaven or the Lord calling her home or whatever. But he doesn't do any of that. You know what he does? He starts singing. He had this song like, 'We're all children in the kingdom of Jesus.' He sings that line a couple times. I think he just made it up in his head. None of us ever heard this song before. We're just standing there like idiots behind him, none of us saying a word. And then he starts with, 'The boys and the girls are children in the kingdom of Jesus. The cats and the dogs are children in the kingdom of Jesus. The mules and the antelopes,' just keeps going and going like he's taking attendance on the ark. Finally, I can't help it anymore. I start giggling. My mother smacks me on the back to shut me up, but I can't help it. I'm trying, damn near wetting myself trying, but I can't. And then suddenly it hits me that I'm laughing at my own sister's funeral. And I get this guilt right in my gut. Hits me like a train. And I start crying harder than I ever cried. But that old man doesn't care. He just keeps on going. The frogs and the horses and the squirrels and—"
Martina chuckled and shook her head.
"I'll never forget that goddamn senile old preacher. How's he gonna go and make a little girl hate herself at her own sister's funeral?"
"Jesus,"
Laura said.
"Maybe y'all really are Catholics."
Soon the first blue of dawn began to leak into the charred sky. After the joyful buzz wore off, Martina excused herself and walked back to her tent. In these hours, the camp was at its calmest, and the tents running afield in all directions were beautiful in a rugged, delicate way. Strange desert fauna, reticent and frozen, a harvest of life. When she reached her tent, she opened the door slowly so as not to wake the children. She stepped inside and saw her son knelt down, pushing something under his mattress. At the foot of his bed, his boots were caked in fresh mud.
"May as well show me whatever it is you got under there," Martina said.
The boy jumped at the sound of his mother's voice. He started to say something, then thought better of it. He reached under the bed and dragged out a black, hard-shell guitar case. The strap showed signs of wear, but the case itself was immaculate for its age, and appeared to Martina to have been at one time used prolifically, but also with great care.
"They give you that?"
Martina asked. Some kind of gift or something?
No,
Simon replied.
Found it in an abandoned studio.
Don't lie to me.
I swear it.
Sit. Simon sat on his bed. His mother sat beside him. She saw he'd cut himself across the left side of the forehead. She inspected the cut with her thumb. Simon pulled back.
You know what they want in return when they start giving the kids round here gifts, right?
Mama, I just stole it is all. I swear. It's not like it was really stealing anyway. It was just sitting there. Nobody was ever going to come back for it.
Martina sighed. If that's what you tell me, that's what I'll believe, she said. But just the same, you're getting old enough that I won't have much of a say in what you're doing or where you're going anymore. So let me say it now. If you want to fight, if that's where you're headed, go to Atlanta when you turn 17 and sign up with the Free Southerners. Put on a uniform. Fight by the rules. I won't like it, but you'll be a man then, and the decision's yours to make. But not the rebels. I don't care what they give you. I don't care what they promise or how they make it sound. You and I both know what they recruit the camp people to do. And I won't have you do that. You understand?
Mama, come on. I'm not going to join any rebels. I'm not going to blow myself up. I won't do nothing like that.
No matter what they tell you, some things are just wrong. War or no war.
I know, Mama.
Martina hugged her son. Then she smacked him on the back of the head.
And it is stealing. Don't do it again.
All right. I'm sorry. She kissed her son goodnight and tiptoed past the sleeping twins in the next room. She reclined on the mattress into which her scent and shape had seeped over the years. She closed her eyes. Sleep came easy.
Excerpted from Neither Breathe Nor Hope, The Untold Story of the South Carolina Wartime Quarantine. In Cairo, the capital of the Bouazizi Empire, the old gray buildings of the students' quarter loom over alleyways of stone and brick. They are tired, pre-revolution buildings, their roofs laden with pigeon coops and thatched janitor's shacks and cracked solar panels. It is frighteningly hot, even in January. For much of the year, it is too hot to be outside. Soon, even the hardest-bitten residents will retreat northward to the Mediterranean seaside or to the burgeoning indoor and underground cities that have largely replaced the ancient ones above the ground. It is too hot to live the old way. But traditions die hard, and, at least in the coolest winter months, many still try. The cacophony of the alleyway bazaars rises from below, the dangling din of the silversmiths, the embers exploding off soot-lacquered grills, the indignant howls of tourists haggling for a bargain, and beyond that, the sounds of the greater metropolis, the airplanes circling Matluti Airport, the Bouazizi Empire's largest hub, a symphony of horns from the unmoving cars along the August 14 bridge, old and new Cairo endlessly colliding. It was in this very neighborhood, three quarters of a century earlier, that the students rushed the alleys of Khen el-Sisi, and the soldiers met them with rifles drawn. Today, there is little to commemorate that massacre but a tired, sputtering fountain whose alabaster tiles leach the rust from the tourists' coins. In his small apartment overlooking the martyrs' fountain, Mahmoud Abdelghafur sits and listens to these sounds coming through the arabesque window coverings. This is not his real name, and this is not his real country. His name is Jerry Tusk, and his country is America. He is a traitor. On January 14th, 2075, the day after Southern rebels killed 38 federal workers in Lexington, the president called a half-dozen government researchers to the executive building in Columbus. They were tasked with devising a way of pacifying the population of the country's first rebel state. 3 months later, a group of War Office agents, who were themselves told the effects of the sickness would end harmlessly in a few months, arrived at a rebel rally at the South Carolina State House with canisters of invisible disease tucked under their jackets. Along the state's northern border, the Blues formed a phalanx larger than any seen during the war. Everyone in the besieged state expected an incursion, but it was in fact
a quarantine. Within a month, the sickness had spread across the state, and the fiery core of the Southern Rebellion had been cooled. The rest of the Free Southern State, after seeing the effects of the virus, quickly put up a quarantine wall of its own. By the time Jerry Tusk arrived at the government labs in Lynchburg 10 years later, the war had turned in the North's favor, and the rebel state, whose induced coma turned the tide for the Blues, was now a glaring embarrassment, the shame of a nation. The young virologist, still new to his work and enthusiastic, was tasked with finding a cure. Unlike most Americans, he would have seen the effects of the slow firsthand. On the last Friday of every month, an armored convoy traveled 5 hours south from Lynchburg to the Carolina quarantine wall. Once across, they found themselves among the comatose. For his guinea pigs, Tusk picked both children in whom the sickness had yet to manifest, and adults fully consumed by it. In this way, he was able to test both cure and inoculation. An alchemist in search of living metal. Most came willingly, ushered into the isolation vehicle by soldiers in thick protective suits. The younger Carolinians, who knew full well what they would soon become, begged to be chosen. The older ones, who were by the age of 30 barely able to do anything more than breathe, eat, and breed, sometimes cursed the Northerners, but were easily compelled. And the eldest were wheeled without protest into the bus, their limbs paralyzed, stiff as stone. Every month, for the better part of a decade, Jerry Tusk would have taken this trip. He would have seen those children plead desperately for a cure he could not give them. Perhaps over time it turned something within him bitter. How cathartic it must have been then, on that April day, when finally 5 of those near-vegetative subjects momentarily came alive, their faces breaking into ecstasy, their fingers gingerly uncurling. How the young scientist must have wept with delight that one of his potions finally worked. How he must have wanted, against his better judgment, to open the fortified door and lead his patients out to the laboratory's great central lawn to show them off like prize crops in spring. And how cruel the universe must have seemed by the end of the same week, as the bodies of the momentarily unfrozen subjects were cast lifeless into the incinerator. In time, the thing Jerry Tusk created would come to be known as the Quick, a virus even more contagious than the one that put Carolina to sleep, and universally lethal. But at the moment of its genesis, he knew it only as he knew all his failed creations, by a simple serial number, 032-072. There exists no written record of the scientist's own thoughts, but it is difficult to imagine those 2 days in April when so bright a light so quickly turned to darkness, and not believe that it was at that moment that Jerry Tusk made the decision to trade his old life for something, anything, else. It is all but known now that the Bouazizi Empire, eager to prolong the American Civil War as much as possible, arranged the deal that granted the virologist his escape. On the morning of December 3, 2094, Jerry Tusk boarded the merchant vessel El Feta at the Richmond Harbor, bound eastward. His lethal creation paid his fare. The following year, the monster he bred would come alive on the steps of Reunification Square in Columbus, Ohio. And the first of more than 100 million people would die. Chapter 6. By the banks of Chalk Hollow, Surratt hunted for pet food. She moved in graceful rampage over the broken branches and dried up leaves, the dead things emitting a satisfying crunch beneath her bare feet. The branches were sharp and the leaves dusted with nettles, but the girl felt none of it. Her soles tough as leather. She knelt and dug into the soil near where it met the water. On the surface, the soil was warm from the sun, but below, it was cooler. She dug an elbow-length hole, looking for the little burrowing worms she recalled from her childhood, but there were none. Soon the bottom of the hole began to fill with river water, and she abandoned it. Nearby, Marcus Exum picked at the fungi growing on the bark of stunted sweet gum trees. He slashed with a penknife at the roots of the wide, white-fleshed mushrooms and placed the bounty in his stitched blanket knapsack. One tree, collapsed completely, was barely visible beneath a second skin of mushrooms. Marcus picked at the parasitic growth until his bag was full, and a small segment of the tree's coal-black bark was bare.
"He'll eat that for sure,"
Surratt said, climbing over the dead tree.
"Heck, I'd eat that."
"I don't know,"
Marcus replied, bending the edges of the mushroom back and forth.
"Maybe it's poisonous. My dad says a lot of this stuff grown out here is. Says anything growing out here people can eat, they already ate."
"We're feeding it to a turtle," Surratt said. "A turtle ain't people."
"Yeah, but poison's poison. It don't know who's eating it."
"Well, she's gotta eat something around here. Keep looking." Surratt wiped the soil from her hands on the sides of her Costco shipping t-shirt and scrambled back down the ravine in the direction of the creek. She was confined to boys' clothes now, there being no girls and hardly any women in the camp as tall as she was, and although it limited her to the worn-through jeans and scuffed shirts that once belonged to Simon and his friends, she found it liberating to no longer be measured against the unbearable standard of her sister, who counted in her sprawling wardrobe not a single piece of clothing fit for adventures like these. She picked the green leaves and tiny flowers of an Alabama supplejack, perched low against the water, its branches limp and thirsty. On the ground, she discovered a small tangle of sweetgum seeds and black peppervine fruit. All these she deposited in her knapsack. A few feet away, a clearing led down to the water's edge. Surratt scrambled down until she was ankle-deep in the warm, muddy creek. A fine sheet of blue-green scum covered the surface of the water. She brushed it away and dipped a thermos into the river and filled it. The water below was tinted brown and, lifted to the light of the sun, glistened with fine particulate. 100 feet beyond, the sheltered estuary of Chalk Hollow fed into Sandy Creek, and a mile further to the east, Sandy Creek met the Tennessee River. Surratt could see the rebel skiffs in the far distance, docked near the ruined wharf of an abandoned marina. When the daylight began to fade, they would cross. Many times the children had seen the rebels, and the rebels had seen the children. Often they crossed paths to Chalk Hollow, where the camp's feeble fencing was bent and torn to shreds. Over the years, the camp's residents had learned not to venture this far east, where the rebel boats docked, nor to the north, where clashes between the rebels and the northern militias had grown more and more frequent. But to Surratt, this place was a small paradise, a land teeming with life, away from the human population and unmagical monotony of the camp itself. Soon, the rebels became used to the sight of the broad, fuzzy-haired girl and her runty friend. They ignored the children, saw in them neither threat nor enticement. The boy was too small, the girl too big. Marcus clambered down the embankment to where Surratt stood.
"We should go," he said.
"Relax. Have some fruit."
Surratt picked 2 black peppervine pebbles and offered one to Marcus, who declined. She shrugged and popped both into her mouth. The skin was mushy and broke open with little resistance. The children marched back inland. For a while, they followed the broken, sand-covered remains of Highway 25, not a mile to the north, lay the severed bridge to the Blue Country. They walked west, toward the now abandoned tents that marked the northern end of the camp. From experience, they knew which tents to avoid, the ones that, though unoccupied, contained the rebels' illicit cargo ferried nightly across Sandy Creek. Officially, these tents near the fence were assigned to refugees long since dead or relocated. And newly arrived refugees, when given assignments here, were quickly warned by more senior residents. Inevitably, they found some way to relocate further south, closer to the camp's interior. The children arrived at a tent near the border between the Mississippi and Alabama slices. It was indistinguishable from all others in the area, but for a rectangular gash on the east-facing canvas, cut there by Surratt, so as to let more sunlight in. Using the Phillips head on his knife, Marcus had learned to turn the door's metal bolt from the outside, and in this way, the children believed they could keep the tent's contents secret from prying eyes. He wrestled with the bolt's screw head for a moment, and the bolt unlocked. The children stepped inside. In the center of the tent, Four cots were stationed on their sides in the shape of a rectangle, forming a makeshift pen. The inside of the pen was lined with charity blankets. A yellow and black-shelled turtle shuffled glumly in one corner of the pen. It was a small, rotund animal, about 6 inches in length. The yellow markings on its back were split with black lines in patterns that resembled the fractal aesthetics of butterfly wings. It moved on ancient, leathery feet, at the ends of which grew sharp, pointed claws that tore softly into the blanket. The animal watched the children approach with a muted consternation. Gently, it retreated into its shell.
"Is he ever going to like us?"
Marcus asked.
"She's a girl," Surratt said. "How do you know she's a girl?" "I found her, so she's a girl." "Is she ever going to like us, then?" "She's going to like us when she sees all the food we got her,"
Surratt replied.
"Maybe we should just take her back to the creek,"
Marcus said, but Surratt brushed him off. She reached into her sack and began laying out the leaves and berries in small mounds on the far end of the pen from where the turtle had backed itself into a corner. Reluctantly, Marcus followed, setting the mushroom heads on the blanket.
"Not like that," Surratt said. "They're bigger than she is. Break them first."
The children lay the food in the pen and then backed away a few feet. Eventually, the turtle re-emerged from its shell. It observed the spread on the other side of the pen, but did not move.
"Maybe she's lonely," Marcus said. "Can't do anything about that,"
Surratt replied.
"When's the last time you saw another turtle anywhere around here? Or a lizard? Or crickets, even?"
"Well, she must have come from somewhere. She was born, so she must have had parents, maybe brothers and sisters, too."
"Just because she had them doesn't mean they're still there."
The children waited a while longer, but the turtle refused to move. Soon Surratt could no longer stand the sight of nothing happening. She marched to the far side of the pen. As she approached, the turtle once more ducked into its shell. Surratt picked the animal up and carried it to the other end of the pen and set it next to the food. Then she stepped back. The turtle re-emerged. It observed the children again with its orange-backed eyes and then turned and shuffled away.
"Damn it,"
Surratt said.
"Maybe we should try my idea," Marcus offered.
"I'm telling you, it won't work,"
Surratt replied.
"That rat is almost as big as she is. She's just going to get more scared. What do we got to lose by trying?"
Surratt acquiesced, and quickly Marcus left and sprinted to his own tent further south. In a few minutes, he returned with a galvanized steel bucket. He held the bucket over the pen and tilted it. A small brown field mouse skittered down the side. All four of the tent's occupants stood frozen, eyeing one another. Then the mouse scurried to the pen's bountiful corner and began eating the berries.
"Well, at least she won't be lonely anymore,"
Surratt said. The children left the tent. They parted in southern Alabama. Marcus returned home. Surratt said she'd come by later in the evening so they could check again on the welfare of their pets.
"You know we're not supposed to go up near the fence at night,"
Marcus said.
"We're not supposed to go up near the fence in the day, either,"
Surratt replied.
"You scared?"
"No."
"Then there's no problem."
Surratt said goodbye and left. She walked south through the western part of Alabama and then into Mississippi. Before she reached home, a couple of boys cut across her path, high with excitement.
"I'm telling you, he lost it in the shit,"
said one of the boys.
"Came off his arm when he was swinging at a fastball and landed right there in the shit."
Curious, Surratt followed the boys. They led her to the banks of Emerald Creek. A crowd of perhaps a dozen boys and girls from the nearby tents were assembled near the foul-smelling sewage ditch. In the center of the commotion was a boy named Ethan. The forlorn boy, who was a year Surratt's senior, was pointing to something in the ditch and arguing with a handful of other boys, all of whom seemed to be talking at once. One of the girls, holding her nose against the stench, caught sight of Surratt approaching.
"Hey, maybe Surratt can get it," she said. "She's bigger than all y'all."
Get what?
Surratt asked. The boys looked her over in a way she'd gotten used to, a cautious curiosity at the girl who was not like the other girls. She ignored them and pushed her way to the banks. In the ditch, the wastewater flowed brown and thick as gravy. It was the pungent soup of the camp's excrement and filth, small crescents of the blue disinfectant that the cleaning staff flushed twice daily down the bowls swirled along the surface. Cigarette butts and empty cans and ration wrappers littered the banks and floated in the effluent. An ancient heirloom wristwatch lay upon a rock in the middle of the creek. Like so many of the functionally deceased things the refugees carried with them, the washed-out photos and the obsolete or corrupted stores of memory and the keys to homes long since bombed or otherwise demolished, it bore a vital link to some distant, happier past.
Used to be my grandfather's, Ethan said.
My mom's gonna kill me if I don't get it back.
So go in there and get it, Surratt said.
Don't be gross. I'm not gonna step in shit.
Another boy whispered something in Ethan's ear. He listened and nodded.
Why don't you get it, Surratt?
He said.
I'll give you $50 if you do.
Surratt shrugged.
All right.
Once more, she pushed the boys aside and walked away from the creek toward the nearest tents. A few of the children followed, among them Ethan, who held Surratt by the wrist and warned her against telling any grown-ups.
I'm not telling anybody, Surratt said, shaking the boy's hand loose. Stop being so scared of everything.
She walked between two tents, where an unused clothesline hung. She unhooked the metal holders on either tent and rolled the line around her fist. Then she returned to the creek. The children followed. At the banks, she uncoiled the line and tossed it into the ditch. On her first try, she fired too far left and then overcompensated. But on the third throw, the hook landed just past the rock on which the watch was stranded. Slowly, she pulled on the line.
Careful! Careful!
Ethan cried from behind her.
You're gonna knock it in!
Be quiet,
Surratt said. She tugged gently on the line until the metal hook rested on the rock just beside the watch. With surgeon's hands, she edged the hook closer until it dislodged the watch from its place. The watch began to slide down the polished side of the rock toward the stream, but caught on the edge of the hook. A couple of the children yelped in triumph.
You got it!
Ethan yelled.
Pull it in! Pull it in!
Hold on,
Surratt said.
Give me that bat of yours.
One of the boys picked up a baseball bat nearby and handed it to Surratt. With the line still in her left hand, she lifted the bat with her right. She held it as far out in front of her as she could without losing her balance. Slowly, she began lifting it up underneath the line to create a pivot point. Then she reeled in the catch. The hook lifted, the watch rising with it. As it came off the rock, the watch swung and skimmed across the surface of the creek. Coiling the line around her wrist, Surratt pulled the watch in and set it on the ground. She turned to Ethan.
Pay up,
she said. The boys stared at the watch on the ground as though it had landed from outer space. Finally, Ethan pulled a wad of redbacks from his pocket and paid Surratt what he owed her. The children began to disperse. Some of the boys revived their baseball game, a little further away from the creek this time. One of the younger girls, whom Surratt did not know, offered to return the clothesline for her. As she made to leave, Surratt was approached by another of the boys, a 14-year-old from Georgia named Michael. She knew him only tangentially. He was the older brother of a boy named Thomas, who as a toddler had suffered a shrapnel injury that had frozen his mind at the age of 2. The older brother had been sleeping in the same bed the night the birds came, but through blind chance had escaped uninjured.
Hey, Surratt. Wait, girl. Where are you going so fast?
Michael said. He pointed at the creek.
I'll give you another 50 if you go in.
The departing children halted. Surratt eyed them, and then Michael. He was wiry and lanky, swimming inside his too big Sinopac Solar t-shirt, a hand-me-down from the Augusta docks. Surratt said nothing.
Come on now. Michael said. You ain't scared, are you?
He had pasted on his face a smirk with which Surratt was well acquainted. She'd seen the same look on so many of the other boys' faces over the years, a self-satisfied grin. It was the smirk of knowing he'd left her with an impossible choice, step into the river of filth or be labeled a coward. Even then, at such a young age, she understood that smile for what it was. A mask atop fear. A balm for the crippling insecurity of childhood's deeply damaged. They were fragile boys who wore it, and their fragility demanded menace. Surratt knew the boys better than they knew themselves, and she knew there was no winning this dare. That was the point, for there to be no winning, only different magnitudes of losing. "How do I know you're not lying?" she said. Michael pulled a wrinkled red back from his pocket. He held it up to Surratt. She inspected the gray pastoral of McCoy Auditorium, the place where Julia Templestowe spit in the northerner's eyes all those years ago, drawn on its back.
"She's not really gonna do it, is she?"
said one of the boys in the crowd. Another boy elbowed him and told him to shut up. Surratt turned away from Michael and took a step down the embankment, easing down with her backside braced against the slope. She descended slowly, the dirt gradually becoming cooler against her feet as she neared the fetid pool. In all her years at Camp Patience, the smell of Emerald Creek had never bothered her, but as she came closer now, there was a thickness to the stench she'd never known before. It overwhelmed the borders between the senses, and soon she could almost taste the acrid sweetness on her tongue. Her throat tightened, and she felt the urge to gag, but fought it. Everywhere in the camp, the bustle of daily life continued unhindered, but here the children stood watching, silent and entranced. Where the embankment met the creek, Surratt's foot disappeared into the brown sludge. She felt the liquid stick to the short hairs of her shin, syrupy and warm. A sharp sigh broke out among the children behind her as her feet went through the surface. She heard a young girl say, "Gross." She realized, then, that she hadn't agreed beforehand with Michael what stepping into the creek really meant. However deep she went, he'd argue she should have gone deeper. Her feet found solid footing on a polished rock when she was knee-deep in the waist. It was shallower than she'd expected. Gently, she eased her backside off the bank and stood upright. She turned to face the boy who dared her. Michael stood at the edge of the creek. He had the same smug smile plastered on his face, but behind it, she could see a tightly reined astonishment, a disbelief that she'd actually gone and done it. Satisfied she'd met the terms of the wager, Surratt eased herself back against the embankment, this time facing forward, her hands braced against the dirt. As she pushed herself up, she heard a muted crack beneath the surface. The rock on which she stood came loose. Suddenly, she was sinking. In an instant, the brown water swallowed her. Instinctively, she closed her eyes and, in the darkness, felt the warmth of it in her hair and on her face. For a moment, she believed she was drowning. A panic reflex, unlike anything she'd ever felt before, took hold of her muscles. Before her eyes were open, she was clawing at the bank, her nails scraping against the rocks and dirt. Like a cornered animal, she thrashed wildly, the fear alive inside her. She climbed back out of the creek, her arms and legs slick with brown muck. It was on her now, the stink. She could smell nothing else. She saw the children laughing at her, the boys most of all. Michael made a big show of it, keeling over, pretending he couldn't breathe from laughing so hard. It was his way of showing he'd won. The smart-ass girl who'd shown all of them up with her little fishing line was now covered in shit. Surratt climbed up on hands and knees until she was back on the flat ground. "I did it," she said. "Give me my money." Michael backed away as she approached. He tossed the bill in her direction. It landed in the dirt at Surratt's feet.
"Jesus Christ," Michael said, still laughing. "You stink."
Surratt picked up the money. She walked past the children, who parted to let her through. A few of them hovered in her periphery as she walked back to her tent. Others, like forward scouts, ran ahead of her to tell their parents and siblings what had happened. The filth stuck to her legs, drops of it trailing behind her in the dirt. She felt something in her hair, moving like tiny insects. When she reached her tent, she found that the news beat her there. Her mother stood outside, waiting.
"What did you do to yourself?" Martina said. Nothing, Surratt replied. It was an instinctual reply. The word came out of her mouth before she knew she'd said it. And as soon as she'd said it, her mother stepped forward and slapped her across the face.
You think we don't have enough problems?
She said.
You think it's not enough that we're stuck here in this hell, killers all around us? You think I don't have enough to deal with? You gotta go make an embarrassment of your family? Make them all laugh at us, too?
Surratt shook her head. Tears welled in her eyes. Most of the children who'd followed her home had left, and now the remaining few were also leaving. Whatever novelty there was to be had in the spectacle of her had suddenly dried up.
You're not coming in here covered in shit, Martina said. You did this to yourself. You go get yourself cleaned up. Nobody fixing your messes from here on in but you.
Fine, Surratt said. I didn't ask you to fix anything. She turned and walked away. She walked east. Dusk settled over the camp. Some of the men who'd slept through the hot middle of the day were now emerging from their tents to sit on their box crates and drink and play cards. Surratt walked past them, and although the breeze carried her smell ahead of her, the men did not notice or seem to care. Near the northern edge of Alabama, she saw a group of about half a dozen men seated around an old folding table. Upon the table sat a tablet connected to a small speaker. The men were watching a recording of the previous week's UFC. It was a title fight at the Citadel in Augusta, one of the better ones in recent memory. All 12 fighters had managed to stay on their feet for the first 7.5 minutes before one was finally knocked out. One of the men watching said there had been a boy from Patience who came close to making the undercard, but lost a fight 2 nights earlier in the qualifiers.
It was one of the Carolina boys, a kid named Taylor, the man said. Mean as hell, they say.
Yeah, but I bet you the whole time he was busy being mean, the other guys were busy fighting, another replied. Mean don't mean nothing.
Marcus Exum stood on the periphery of the men's viewing circle. He was perched on an upturned laundry basket, craning for a look at the screen. When he saw Surratt, he jumped down and ran to her.
Hey, hey,
he said, tapping her on the elbow.
What are you doing?
Don't touch me, Surratt said. Marcus recoiled. She saw in his eyes a sudden burst of confusion and hurt.
I don't mean it like that, she said. I'm covered in shit. I stink.
So what? Marcus said.
Take a shower, then. Got no clothes to change into. My mom won't let me in the tent, says I embarrassed her. I bet if you go say you're sorry, she'll...
I'm not sorry, Surratt said, loud enough that a couple of the men watching the fight looked up.
I'm not sorry, and none of them can make me sorry. They're liars and cowards, all of them. They pretend like this is normal, like it's normal to live this way, but it's not normal. Your dad's right. We're just waiting to die, waiting for the blues to come up over that fence one day and kill every last one of us. I'm not sorry. I'm not the one who's wrong.
I don't think you're wrong, Marcus said. I've never thought you were wrong.
Go to the shower trailer. I'll get you some clothes from our tent. My dad's not that much bigger than you anyway.
Surratt walked up the dirt path to the northernmost shower trailer in the Alabama slice. It was a rusted metal and vinyl shack on blocks. Inside, it smelled of mildew and the candy cardamom scent of the cleansing lotion packets that arrived by the box load every month from the Augusta docks. They were small, clear packets, like the kind condiments come in. They littered the ground, caught in the drains, and stuck to the undersides of feet. All but the most well-connected of Camp Patience's residents used the packets to wash their hair and skin. And yet, none of the residents ever smelled like the slimy amber liquid. Only the shower trailers did. Surratt entered the trailer and stripped down. She piled her clothes on the ground under the showerhead in one of the three stalls and turned the hot water tap. In a minute, steam began to churn about the room. The water melted the crust of filth from the clothes, and a briny, sulfuric smell filled the trailer. Surratt stepped into the adjacent stall. She turned the tap. The water was cold. Her skin erupted in goosebumps, and the fine hairs on her forearms rose. She stood, with her head bowed, watching the milky brown water swirl around the drain. On the back of the stall door there was all manner of graffiti, symbols of the Southern militias, genitals drawn cartoonish and grotesque,
addresses of tents in which lived the whores and thieves and traitors. Soon the water ran clear. Surratt heard the trailer door open. She heard Marcus walk inside, his footsteps almost indecipherable under the rush of water and squealing pipes. She heard him set the clothes on the bench by the wash basin, and then she heard the squeak of the trailer door once again opening and closing. But when the sound was gone, she knew Marcus had not left. She knew he was still standing inside the room, and through the tiny sliver where the door hinges met the stall, she could feel his eyes on her. With her head still lowered, she saw what he saw. The topography of her body. The shoulders, wide and thick. The breasts that on any other girl her age would have stood as mounds, but on her frame were modest. The hips in line with the shoulders, in line with the thighs. The body, big and uncurved. A brick of a girl. And to his eyes, she knew the strangest prize was the place between the lines, the place that had in this last year turned against her in a way so sudden she thought at first she was dying. The place that in an instant made her a stranger to herself. And she knew that if she were simply to look up and catch his stare, the boy would flee, would not even beg forgiveness later, but instead would die right there of shame. For the first time in her life, she owned a pair of eyes other than her own, and with her head bowed, she kept them locked upon her. In the thick sweat of steam, both boy and girl, for a moment, were entranced by the same skin. The flow of water began to weaken, and the pipes let out a rumbling whistle. Surratt shut the tap. As the water died, she heard Marcus scurry from the trailer. Outside the stall, she found an Ali Baba shirt and a pair of slouch jeans worn white at the knees. The shirt fit her well enough, but the pants were loose around her hips. She picked her old shirt from the soaked pile on the floor and tore it apart. She took one half of the ruined fabric and braided it, wringing the water out as she did. Then she ran it through the belt loops and tied it tight. When she stepped out of the shower trailer, she found Marcus seated on the bottom step, his arms hugging his shins. She sat beside him. In the early nighttime hours, the camp was alive with chatter and wandering flashlights and the fungal sweat of cooking. The sounds of the Free Southern Radio came high and tinny through portable speakers. She looked at Marcus, but he looked at his feet. She sensed that between her and her friend, one wall had come crumbling down, but another, different one, had taken its place. And although she couldn't define it, she knew what it was. She knew it to be a cousin of that low-lit language her sister spoke so well. It lived in that strange, fevered place between curiosity and desire. And it thrilled her. Not the sex of it, but the newness, the realization that she could not only manipulate these feelings within herself, but also without. That she could turn the gears inside another so forcefully. Finally, he spoke.
My dad, when he falls asleep, nothing can wake him.
I'm not staying in your tent, Surratt said.
Then where are you gonna stay?
I'll go bunk in the pen with Sherilyn and that rat of yours, if she hasn't eaten him already. Plenty of room there. Marcus turned and held Surratt by the forearm.
Please don't stay up there. You know it's not safe. My dad says the Blue Militias are going to tear through that fence any night now.
And I believe him. But what are the odds it'll be tonight?
What if it is tonight?
Then we'll all be dead anyway.
Where you want me to stay then?
Go down to the sick building, Marcus said.
Tell them you got the flu or something. They'll let you stay the night there.
The sick building hasn't been open since last Christmas, said Surratt.
They still got a couple bunks in there. Nobody's using them for anything.
They were jolted from their conversation by a crack of gunfire, a single shot, ringing in the air somewhere to their north. It was a sound they'd heard a million times before, a sound unanchored and without destination.
Please don't stay up there tonight,
Marcus said.
All right,
Surratt replied. The two friends sat together at the foot of the stairs and watched an old woman patch a square hole in her tent with some thread and a piece of blanket. Surratt squirmed.
What's the matter?
Marcus asked.
My hair is itchy,
Surratt said.
Didn't you wash it?
Yeah. She scraped her nails against her scalp until she worried it would bleed. Still, trails of invisible ants marched through the fuzzy corkscrews of her hair.
Your dad have clippers?
She asked.
Yeah. Go get him.
Marcus sprung up and ran back to his tent. Soon, he returned with an old electric clipper and three attachments. Surratt fit one of the attachments and turned on the clipper. It buzzed and vibrated in her hand. Cautiously, she set it just above her forehead, and for a moment, she felt nothing. Then came a slight tug at the roots, and soon she saw the rough strands float gently past her to the ground. She moved the clipper slowly, in part out of caution, but also to prolong the act. The shearing felt good against her skin. Soon, the clipper glided along smoothly, and no more hair fell.
Did I miss anywhere?
She asked. Marcus shook his head. Surratt set the clipper on the stairs, its teeth still clogged. She rubbed her hand against the felt of her scalp. She stood.
You're a good friend,
she told Marcus. And then she left. She walked to the administrative buildings. She sat by the infirmary's back door and waited. Across the nearby walking path, she saw the southernmost of the Alabama tents. Among them was one whose entire east-facing side had long ago been torn beyond repair. In its place, the old woman living there had tied down a large flag of the Free Southern State. In time, the flag had faded, the red bars made ghostly pink, the three black stars barely visible. Surratt observed the flag. She'd seen it a million times, decorating the tents and strung high on poles and etched into a currency whose worth eroded by the day. But she never paid much attention to it. It had always seemed to her that the South was the governing ground of two different powers, the official Free Southern State government, headquartered in Atlanta, whose soldiers did almost no fighting, and the vast array of rebel groups, who did nothing but fight. She knew the three stars on the flag represented the three states of the MAG, and she knew if South Carolina hadn't been turned into a forest of living dead, there would be a fourth. Looking at the flag, Surratt noticed the black stars were slightly asymmetric. The right-pointing sides were longer than the others. She recalled hearing one of the older refugees say that in Atlanta, in the first year after declaring independence, the Free Southerners scrambled to create a flag and compose an anthem. In their panic, they botched the stars and never could agree on an anthem. And so in his address at the revealing ceremony, President Kershaw made up the famous line about how the pained wail of the South's anguished people was the state's only song, and never mentioned the misdrawn stars. Surratt thought about how easy it would be to fix the mistake, to simply redraw the stars properly. But she knew that even broken history is history. The stars, cast wrong, must remain that way. It would be more wrong to change them. She fell asleep, thinking about it, seated against the wall, curled up like a cashew with her knees for pillows. When she woke, it was well past midnight, and the camp was quiet. She walked around the infirmary building to where a large waste disposal bin sat below a small window. She climbed up and stood at the window. The pane made a square barely big enough to accommodate her circumference, and she worried that even if she managed to slide the glass open, she would get stuck trying to climb inside. The lights overhead glanced sharply off the window. Surratt saw her reflection in the glass. With her hair shaved, her face looked fuller, rounded in a way that unveiled its symmetry. There was a smoothness in how the jaw became the skull, and the skull an almost polished half-mirror to the light. Surratt observed her new face a long time. In the back of her mind swirled all manner of looming irritations. Her mother's wrath, the ceaseless teasing of the children who'd seen or, by now, heard what she'd done. But in this moment, alone with her reflection, she felt new and impossibly light. The pane was of a flimsy plastic and gave slightly when Surratt pushed on it, but in the groove on the other side there was a thick woodblock, and it prevented the window from sliding open. She tried to dig her fingers in and lift the pane out entirely,
She became so caught up in this task that she didn't notice the shadow climbing up the wall, a shadow in the shape of a man who now stood behind her.
"Whatever it is you're looking for," he said, "I doubt you'll find it here."
Surratt jumped and stumbled back, nearly falling off the waste bin. She turned to see a man of about 60, dressed in a black, pre-war suit lined with white, thin stripes. She'd never seen him before. He was short, a half-foot shorter than Surratt, even aided by the thick heels of his polished dress shoes. He wore a stiff black Homburg. Its brim kept the overhead lights from illuminating his face.
"I'm not stealing,"
Surratt said.
"Are you going to tell?"
"Don't worry. I won't tell on you," the man said. "What's your name?"
"Surratt."
"Hello, Surratt. My name is Albert Gaines."
He had a slightly low, even voice with a sliver of Mississippi drawl, one wide vowel cozying up to the next. It reminded Surratt of the announcer on the Peachtree Variety Hour her mother liked to listen to on Friday nights, a soothing, familiar voice.
"How old are you, Surratt?"
he asked.
12.
"And why are you dressed in someone else's clothes?"
The question caught her off guard, and for a moment she wondered if the old man had been watching when she went in the creek. But she knew he hadn't. Every face that watched her was etched in her memory now. She'd remember every single one, every smile, every snicker, forever.
"I jumped into Emerald Creek."
"And why would you do that?"
"A dare."
Gaines smiled. Along the skin between the ends of his lips and the dark crescents beneath his eyes, Surratt saw small craters, markers of time and damage.
"Come down from there," he said. "I have a business proposition for you."
Surratt climbed off the waste bin and approached the man. She imagined him a dignitary, one of the representatives the Free Southerners dispatched from Atlanta every now and then to gauge the mood of the refugees and spread word of recent concessions by, and humiliations of, the Blues. But those were different beasts. They dressed in cheap, formless shirts and wore pins in the shape of the Southern flag and stammered for hours without saying anything of value. In the eyes of the refugees, those men were little more than dull sparks launched off the gears of some distant machine. Gaines retrieved a small yellow envelope from his breast pocket.
"I have an acquaintance to whom I need this letter delivered," he said. "His name is Leonard, and he lives in Row 9, Tent 9, in the South Carolina sector."
"All right," Surratt said.
"You're not afraid of going to South Carolina?"
"No."
"Don't you want to know how much I'm willing to pay?"
Surratt paused. The man chuckled.
"Don't worry. This isn't a dare.
It's a job.
Jobs pay."
He handed her the envelope.
"Go on, then.
Let's see how you do."
Surratt took the envelope. On its back, the name Leonard was written in impeccable cursive. She walked southeast, past the administrative buildings, and in the direction of the camp's main gate. Like the rest of the refugees from the other states, she'd never ventured into South Carolina. She'd only heard stories of it, of mean, bitter people, the last uninfected remnants of their quarantined state. Once, years earlier, the South Carolina slice was the largest in the camp. But over the years, the sector had shrunk, ceding its northern and western borders to Alabama and Georgia. Because from those states, there was still a regular flow of refugees, but nobody else was leaving South Carolina. The whole state was walled off, sealed. Surratt walked past unadorned tents, their tears left, for the most part, unmended. A few men sat on plastic chairs, reading and playing dominoes. They observed her as she passed. She reached her destination to find a couple of boys playing cards on a rice sack table. They were perhaps 14 or 15, the one with his back to her a buzz-cut redhead, the other a spindly blonde, naked, but for a pair of double-star shorts. Beyond them, and beyond the tent in the distance, the soft white lights of the camp's main gate burned. And beyond those gates, the great southern world, its cratered cities and salt-eaten coasts and parched, blistered gut,
lay waiting. It was a world that for Surratt now existed only in the fiery sermons of radio preachers and the lyrics of war songs and the bucolic pastorals of Free Southern State propaganda.